Longtime leader David Rolfe is stepping down as president of Service Employees International Union 775. First elected in 2003, he was the founding president of the local union. You're listening to KNKX. I'm Simone Alicea. Rolfe and SEIU have been major political players in Washington. That includes the campaign to enact a $15 an hour minimum wage for some SeaTac airport workers. Voters in SeaTac approved the measure in 2013, encouraging similar efforts across the country. I sat down with Rolfe to talk about the union and the future of organizing, and I wanted to start with lessons learned from the SeaTac campaign.
It was a hard campaign, as you probably remember. The yes side prevailed by a mere 77 votes on election day in 2013. Really, I think the campaign was about two things. It was, first of all, about a group of very low-wage workers who depended on food banks to get by, standing up to major airlines and to the Port of Seattle and saying enough is enough, that we're sort of tired of waiting for port commissioners or for CEOs to do the right thing. The second thing that we really did is led a discussion about what in SeaTac, about what kind of community that the residents there wanted to have. In addition to kind of the group of workers in SeaTac who were in effect voting themselves a raise, there was also a broader dialogue about whether this community wanted to be a middle-class community or whether only the shareholders of the airline companies were going to benefit from corporate growth and profit.
So you have the $15 minimum wage campaign in SeaTac, and then shortly after that, $15 minimum wage in Seattle, which you also were on that team that helped come up with that plan. We're seeing minimum wage increases from the ballot statewide as of 2016, in addition to other labor protections, you know, family leave, things like that. All of this brings me to sort of the flip side, which is that SEIU 775 and you specifically have been accused of being sort of too cozy with politics. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's funny. I would never have thought of us as being cozy with politics or politicians. We hold politicians accountable, and we do that by helping elect those that have demonstrated they're willing to fight hard for working families, and we do that by helping to unelect those who have betrayed working families. But I don't think we've ever been afraid to stand up even to our friends.
Like in what way?
Well, for example, we helped elect Chris Gregoire as governor, but when her budgets during the recession proposed all cuts strategies that would have hurt our members and the people they care for, caregivers protested, picketed, committed acts of civil disobedience, got arrested, and for that matter, ran ballot measures to fight against the cuts in Olympia with a great deal of success.
I want to talk about the future of labor and the future of organizing, and I actually want to start with the Supreme Court. And I want to start with Harris and Janus. Now that it's been decided, what does that mean? How much of a risk is that for a union like SEIU 775?
You know, what the Harris and Janus decisions essentially did is say that if you are a union, you have to represent all the workers in a given workplace, but only the ones who feel like it have any obligation to financially support the organization. Janus had a pretty small impact on SEIU 775. Harris arguably had a little bigger of one, but you know, the reality is that the vast majority of our members maintain their union membership on a voluntary basis, even under these two bad Supreme Court rulings. But it does, I would say, lead us to a bigger question, which is, why does America have this silly opt-in, workplace-by-workplace, enterprise-based system of collective bargaining to begin with? What can we learn from global examples? What can we learn from innovative startup worker organizations? And are there better models of labor law that we should be serving up to the next pro-worker administration in Washington?
So are you thinking in Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
Well, both. There's a lot the governors and mayors can do to innovate the future in labor law, even with so-called federal preemptions in the National Labor Relations Act. And ultimately, you know, what is almost always true is that in the United States, significant domestic policy innovations are generally prototyped at the city or state level, but ultimately we need better federal labor laws that aspire to the outcome of building a big, inclusive, stable, growing, and prosperous middle class that anyone who works can join.
So that, to you, is sort of the future then, is the not so much the nitty-gritty of how do we make sure we can maintain our membership, but what is the broader end game here?
Yeah, the broader end game is really all about the outcomes. It's not about the process and whether or not this particular set of organizations adapts and survives or doesn't isn't nearly as important as whether or not there are civic institutions in the country that can provide a powerful voice for workers, working families, and those who aspire to be in the middle class, and ultimately hold both politicians and employers accountable to those outcomes.
For all the other union leaders who are still working at their locals, what's the future of organizing look like for them?
There are certainly still unions that are helping unorganized workers organized using the old enterprise-based worksite-by-worksite model, but it's hard to imagine how that ever gets back to representing a third of the workforce like it did in the 1950s. I am a firm believer that today's labor leaders need to think hard about how we invest in new models, how we take some of our talent and some of our assets and not merely serve the institutions and the people that exist, but how we create and lay the groundwork for new organizations that will have the power, the scale, and the sustainability to really be transformative in the lives of all workers in the 21st century. You know, I think today's labor leaders will be remembered not for the strikes they led or the contracts they bargained, but for whether they had the courage to break out of the model that has been sort of the default operating system for the labor movement since the 1930s and create the next model that really has the power to hold government and corporations accountable to whether or not there's a big inclusive middle class in the 21st century.
All right. David Rolfe, outgoing president of SEIU 775. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Rolfe is leaving the union after hitting a 15-year term limit as president, and he says he'll continue working with other SEIU affiliates and labor think tanks. Rolfe will be succeeded by Vice President Sterling Harters. She takes office October 1st.